Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Explaining History podcast, and in this episode I'm going to talk about European diplomacy from 1909 to 1912, a brief period really from 1909 to about 1911 whereby tensions were actually declining. However, the decline in tensions across Europe was really illusory. It was what the historian Sean McMeekin refers to as an Indian summer, meaning that it was an unnaturally long interlude of calm in volatile European affairs. And once this had come to an end, the circumstances that make a European war more likely are highly prevalent and unfold with great speed between 1912 and 1914. The first Bosnian crisis of 1908, in which the Austro-Hungarian Empire annexed the region of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which they had held as a mandate since the Congress of Berlin, but in 1908 it firmly becomes part of Austro-Hungarian territory, had been an event which came close to plunging all of Europe into the kind of war that finally happens in 1914. Russia and Serbia, outraged over the annexation and the transference of Bosnian citizens, former citizens, former subjects of the Ottoman Empire, into subjects of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, had threatened war. And it had only been the threat of Germany weighing in on Austria's side which had stayed Russia's hand. Russia, having fought and lost a disastrous war with Japan in 1905 and endured the revolutionary period in 1904 and 1905, which came very close to unseating the Tsar and spread chaos across the Russian Empire, was in no hurry to engage in a war with a power perhaps even more likely to cause devastation to Russia than Japan. It was this, the first Bosnian crisis, and the avoidance of the first of war over Bosnia the first time round, that seems to have given Europe a few extra years of relative peace before the crisis explodes again in 1914, when in the Bosnian capital Sarajevo, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sofia of the Austro-Hungarian Empire were assassinated by Serbian nationalists. Bosnia-Herzegovina was, of course, a Serbian kind of irredenta land, the territories that the Serbs believed they always had a claim over. The country was divided ethnically between Bosnian Serbs, I beg your pardon, and Ottoman Bosnians, Bosnian Muslims, who, and there were, of course, a variety of other nationalities dotted throughout the territory, such as Croats and Slovenes and other Balkan peoples. And if you read Christopher Clark's brilliant book, The Sleepwalkers, he writes a very vivid chapter on how Serbian nationalism, when Serbia emerged from the Ottoman Empire finally in full independence after 1878, Serbian nationalism was a very vital, powerful, growing, assertive and aggressive force, which really knew no confines. Territories outside Serbian borders, such as Bosnia-Herzegovina, which the Serbs traditionally lay claim to, and had large pockets of Serbian peoples living there, became the flashpoint of Serbian nationalism, and became their claims on those lands became deeply seated within Serbian folk culture, a resurgent and vibrant Serbian folk culture, which had emerged as Serbia became an independent nation state. By 1910, however, tensions across Europe were in relative decline. The naval race between Britain and Germany, for example, which after 1906 and the launching of the HMS Dreadnought, began to go into gradual decline. Germany had realised it had lost the race and couldn't match the Royal Navy in terms of tonnage, though at the Battle of Jutland in terms of shells, gunnery and most other measures, it matches the Royal Navy shot for shot. The Chancellor of Germany, Bethmann Hollweg, decided that it was time to forge a more consensual path with Great Britain, and wanted to pull the plug on the naval race altogether by essentially offering to scrap the High Seas Fleet, or much of it. This was unacceptable to the Kaiser and to the naval minister, Alfred von Tirpitz, who had pushed through the three naval bills since the start of the century. In addition to this decline in tensions over shipbuilding and arms races between Britain and Germany, Russia began to ease its stance towards Germany as well. Izvolsky, who had been the foreign minister at the time of the first Bosnian crisis, resigned, and he was replaced by Sergei Sazonov, who was far more interested in cordial relations with Germany. Sazonov was well aware that the revolution of 1905 could not under any circumstances be repeated, and Russia could not afford another major war. In one instance of conciliation and cooperation, Russia under Sazonov made an arrangement in 1910 that the Berlin-Baghdad railway that was being built between Germany and Mesopotamia would also have a line that ran to the border with Persia. And this would be balanced out by a promise from Germany, extracted from Germany, that it would not support any further aggressive actions by Austria in the Balkans. This would by extension take the heat off Russia in terms of its Balkan policy, much of which was motivated by wounded national pride and traditional Pan-Slavic alliances and a traditional Pan-Slavic worldview from Russia that it must be the defender of the Serbs and the Slavic-speaking Slavic peoples of the Balkans. A vivid symbol of European cooperation in 1910, or at least European conciliation in 1910, was the stellar turnout in London for the funeral of Edward VII, in which nearly every head of state across Europe turned out to pay their respects. Edward VII, Bertie, was by and large highly respected. I think I've previously done a podcast on the Entente Cordiale, the Anglo-French agreement in 1904, and the involvement of Edward VII in that as a kind of honest broker between France and his home country, Great Britain. However, this brief period of calm was one which kind of papered over the cracks of fundamental divisions across Europe. The Balkan issue had not gone away and was destined to resurface, and the resentment that the Russians and the Serbs had of the Austrian annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina had not gone anywhere. There had been an attempt at conciliation by Sazonov, but by and large, that these kinds of attitudes didn't dissipate. Izvolsky, when he resigned, was given the job of the ambassador to Paris. And when he was in situ there, he spent his time, as ambassadors in the 19th century were often able to do, away from St. Petersburg, away from the confines of government, and was able to operate a kind of parallel foreign policy, one which was notionally a Russian foreign policy, but was really an Izvolskian one. So Izvolsky himself was using his office to plot his vengeance on the Austrians and the Germans. The Serbs were outraged, and from 1908 onwards, Serbian nationalism was defined by its opposition to and hatred of Austria and Germany, but particularly Austria. The Narodna Odbrana, or National Defence Organisation, a secret society, formed itself, but also did the Union or Death Organisation, which was also known as the Black Hand. So it was the first Bosnian crisis that created the organisations within the within Serbia that would precipitate the second Bosnian crisis and the First World War, or it would create the spark for the First World War anyway. It's perhaps more useful to look at the two Bosnian crises as really one and the same set of historical processes.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
For our purposes, Austrian Foreign Minister Aerenthal, following the annexation of Bosnia, had decided that it might be a good idea to offer other European powers a degree of compensation for the concession that would be granted to Austria. Now, this was a policy that had really been pioneered 20 years earlier at the Berlin Congress of 1884 to 85. And the Berlin Congress was a meeting of great powers to decide the orderly division and partition and colonisation of Africa. the carving up of Africa. This was the kind of the key moment of the scramble for Africa. Spheres of influence were established, and colonies were horse traded between different colonizers. And that meant that when the British were given concessions in East Africa, that they had to give favours and concessions to the Belgians or the French in other parts of the continent. And now this process was being applied in Europe. The fact that the practices that were being applied to Africa and Asia were returned to Europe foreshadowed the Great War in many ways. The destruction of the First World War and the unparalleled level of violence and brutality in Europe perpetrated on Europeans by Europeans had in part been pioneered in the half century of colonisation beforehand. If you think about the levels of mass killing and starvation and murder that were perpetrated in German Southwest Africa, in the Belgian Congo, or during the Indian Mutiny, the suppression of the Indian Mutiny of 1857, you get a taste of, you get a clue of the levels of destruction that were then perpetrated by Europeans on Europeans. And the introduction shortly after the First World War, and certainly by the end of the Second World War, of the level of racial thinking that was injected into Europe, the kind of racism that had seemed commonplace and everyday in Europe's colonies and seemed and had almost a degree of public legitimacy when applied to Europe's colonies, was considered monstrous when brought back to Europe itself. And the practices of empire really do seem to kind of have had a kind of a blowback, I think would be the modern term, back into Europe and have kind of infected European foreign policy, European warcraft, the state of militarism in Europe, and a number of other things. The Ottoman Empire was compensated for the loss of control over Herzegovina, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Erenthal said that he would withdraw Austrian troops from the Sanjak of Novi Pazar, which was a strip of land between Bosnia-Herzegovina and Serbia and Montenegro. The Serbs and the Montenegrins were basically separated by the Sanjak of Novi Pazar and the garrison of Austrian troops that were there. But the Ottomans didn't view this as a particularly attractive prospect. They knew that putting their troops there would gain them nothing in terms of strategic advantages. They were surrounded by enemies on both sides, and they saw this gift from the Austrians as being the kind of the worse than consolation prize that it actually was. And they were given a salient of land which was basically undefendable. The Austrians had basically sent a big signal to the Serbs and the Montenegrins that the Sanjak of Novi Pazar could be invaded whenever they wanted to do so, now that the Ottomans didn't fancy garrisoning it very particularly. Rome has also sent a strong message by Erenthal, and this has far more significant consequences. Obviously, Italy, unified in 1861 and a latecomer to the imperial game, was bitterly resentful of the other imperial powers of Europe and saw colonies and imperial expansion as part of the legitimising process of any European nation state. Without an empire, what is the country really? Italy, since 1882, had been part of the Triple Alliance with Berlin and Vienna. But Austria, Hungary and Italy had been traditionally rivals. There had been a long enmity throughout the 19th century with bitter resentments going back into the formation of Italy and the domination of Italy by Austria. And the plan that Italy had, which was very poorly concealed, was the designs along the Adriatic coastline, what would now be Croatia, the Dalmatian coastline. And the Italians believed, because there was a large proportion of Italian speakers there, a large Italian ethnic minority, that this should go to them, along with Austrian Trieste and South Tyrol in the Alps. All of these were war aims for Italy during the First World War. Italians were outraged by the annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina because they thought that if anybody should be compensated, if any parts of the former Ottoman Empire should be divided up and handed to a European power, it should be the Dalmatian coastline handed to Italy. These would eventually be referred to after the First World War as the Irredentalands, and irredentism becomes a key phrase throughout the 20th century of sort of frustrated expansionist nationalism. One of the last acts of Izvolsky, before he stepped down in 1910, was to try to come to an arrangement with Italy, between Russia and Italy. They wanted to establish a bilateral security agreement, which was essentially an anti-Austrian pact. Russia would offer support for Italian claims in Libya, Tripolitania and Cyrenaica, which is comprises modern-day Libya. These were two provinces of the Ottoman Empire, and they're the last Ottoman outposts in Africa. Italy had basically secured promises from Germany and Britain that they would allow whatever Italy's actions in Libya might be. Germans and the British aren't very concerned by Italy, by Libya, and it doesn't really appear on their kind of radar particularly. Ehrenthal in Austria said, well, perhaps if you gave us some leeway over the Bosnian annexation, you didn't protest it too much, we might not protest if you were to seize Libya. And so this kind of horse trading from the 1870s onwards was a real driver of European imperialism, particularly in Africa. If there were favours that one European power could do for another, then another European power might look the other way, not protest, relax its claims on somewhere or other, in order to allow a colonisation or land grab to occur. The Russians, of course, were looking at the Dardanelles Straits, the Bosphorus, and the route from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, and that was the bit of Ottoman territory that they rather wanted to annex, and thought that a crisis in Libya might help them to do that. In 1911, the second Morocco crisis began. The first one in 1905 saw the Kaiser Wilhelm visit the Moroccan Sultan Abdelaziz in Tangier, and the Germans thought that this would be, or particularly the Kaiser thought that this would be a great way to put pressure on the new Anglo-French Entente. If Morocco, which was in the French sphere of influence, could be interfered with by the Germans, it would be interesting to see what the British would do and whether they would back down. This didn't work, and the failure of the plan by the Kaiser led to an agreement by most of Europe's powers on the rights of France in Morocco, so it spectacularly backfired. In 1911, the new Sultan, Abdul Hafid, who was facing a rebellion from the Berber tribes people in Morocco, asks France for military assistance, and the French were more than happy to oblige. The SMS Panther, a German battleship, arrived at the same time, or roughly the same time, and weighed anchor at the Atlantic port of Agadir. The war possibilities over Morocco loom large. Not only has France staked its claim to Morocco and its desire to intervene on behalf of its puppet ruler. But now the German Navy has sent a battleship in order to send an ominous message to all parties. The British began to think seriously about war with Germany. And it was only the same old bit of colonial horse trading, with the Germans being given parts of the Congo in return for French control over a new protectorate of Morocco, that prevented World War I from breaking out over North Africa. However, this presented a golden opportunity for Italy to now wage war on the Ottoman Empire in order to seize their hoped-for colony in Libya. In the next podcast, or well, one later in the week, I'll be covering the Ottoman-Italian War of 1911, and we'll go into that in slightly greater depth than we've got time for now. Anyway, thanks for listening. Hope you find this useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.